Hello and welcome to the Permaculture Podcast with Scott Mann, a listener-supported program. This episode is the second part of the Susquehanna Permaculture Roundtable discussion held earlier this year. We pick up where we left off with the four panelists and the live audience, though this time we settle in and discuss a series of listener questions taken from the Facebook page at facebook.com/thepermaculturepodcast, as well as from the live listening audience. If you're new to the podcast and have not heard part one, you'll find a link to that in the show notes. And there you can hear the biography and background of the roundtable panelists. If you enjoy this episode and would like to hear more roundtables like this, please support the show. You can find out how by going to thepermaculturepodcast.com/support, where you can make a one-time or continuing monthly contribution to the show. Everything helps me continue to produce additional shows like this one. Now then, on to part two of the Susquehanna Permaculture Roundtable. I'll join you afterwards with some notes and updates. Hello everyone, and thank you for joining me again for the second session of our roundtable discussion with John Darby, Rafika Muhammad, Shannon Silty, and Boris Yeltsin. We're going to get things started off by making this session less of a general conversation and more to get directly to some question and answers that have been coming in off of Facebook and from the folks here in the audience. The first of these questions is from Phil Garrity, and his question was, what is the best way to use chickens within a permaculture growing system? And I think, John, you had some opinions on this?
Yeah, I definitely have some thoughts on chickens. I did chickens on the farm for 1 year. I did egg layers and broilers. And I did sort of use the Joel Salatin style movable chicken tractors. During the course of that year, I discovered that I did not want to be a chicken farmer and did not have the time or patience to do both vegetables and chickens. That said, they can be a really valuable asset. They're really good workers as far as running through your beds when you're done with them to, you know, eat weed seeds, eat bugs, kind of scratch up and fertilize the ground there to get it ready for the next planting. I can't speak to any certain level of expertise on it, but I would say there's a writer named Harvey Ussery who has a really great book, and I've seen him speak, and he's got a pretty good method to moving them through the garden on sort of a routine basis. And it involves sort of having your vegetable beds, as soon as you harvest and finish a vegetable bed, immediately put down some quick growing cover crop, whether it's buckwheat or oats. That grows quickly, then run the chickens through to kind of eat and incorporate that and return it to the ground in the form of fertilizer. So start there, look him up. He may even have some YouTube videos, I'm not sure. Ben, did you have thoughts on chickens?
This is Ben, aka Boris Yeltsin. I have a similar opinion to John. I worked with chickens in a small urban farm for 1 year, and there were benefits and drawbacks. The main benefits were we had the chicken run set up at the end of all of the rows, and we would weed every day from the end farthest from the chickens towards the chickens. And when we were finished weeding the row, there we were with a basket full of, you know, forage for the chickens that we threw over the fence for them. Similarly, we did almost all of the pest control by hand. I'm a big proponent of intensive gardening systems for annual vegetables. And with minimal chemical input, we were walking down the rows with a little Coke bottle full of water in one hand. You'd pick off the pests, you know, cabbage worms or Japanese beetles or harlequin beetles, drop them in the bottle. And if they didn't, well, some of them would drown, but not all of them. Most they would, you know, float on the water. And then when we got over to the chicken run, we would just call the chickens into the coop, dump out the bugs, and the chickens would just go to town and take care of them for us. I do think that in an intensive vegetable garden production system, especially the kind, you know, that is known as synergistic, that was pioneered by Amelia Hazlip in France, who unfortunately there's not a lot of great info on, but there is a really low quality half hour documentary on her garden that can be found on YouTube. It is actually essential in that kind of a system to have some kind of poultry or fowl that moves through that system periodically. You know, Bill Mollison famously answered a student's question about an overabundance of slugs in her garden by saying, you don't have an overabundance of slugs, you have a lack of ducks to eat them. That being said, I think that there are birds that are better than chickens to incorporate into a system like that. I've never raised ducks, but most of my colleagues who have say that they're significantly easier to work with than chickens, and easier to control and easier to integrate into a garden.
My last farming experience was on a 1-acre urban farm called the Joshua Farm in Harrisburg City. It was mainly a CSA, but they would sell vegetables for market as well. And we had a chicken tractor there. And one of the things, we tried to comply with food safety regulations. So if you're growing commercially, there's a certain time limit after you run the chickens through each row. I think it's something like 10 to 11 months or something like that. So if you have a really intensive system that might, and you're selling your vegetables, that might not be very practical. Also, I've done a lot of reading because I've been nomadic. I haven't been able to. I've had experience raising chickens, but it was really short-lived. In the wintertime, you can keep your chickens in your greenhouse and they will help heat it a little bit more. And so you have a contribution to the passive solar. I've also heard that ducks are a lot easier than chickens, with the exception of they lay eggs all over the place and not in one spot like chickens do.
I have no experience in raising chickens. And I think in some of my permaculture designs, I'm not interested in incorporating chickens, even though some of the people I've been working with have been bringing it up. But I will say, check out your ordinances, check out your ordinances, check out your ordinances. Scott's laughing because we know we went through that. I know if you're in certain municipalities, particularly in cities, you need at least about an acre in order to incorporate chickens into your vegetable gardens. And you also need to include or have a conversation with the community. The community might not want chickens with all the smells, the noise, etc. So I would just say before you incorporate them into your gardens, do that kind of research and background first.
To add to what Shannon was saying about, you know, food safety concerns and regulations, I do know off the top of my head that on a certified organic farm, you're not allowed to apply raw manure to a crop. For a crop whose edible part does not touch the ground, the raw manure can't be applied any less than 90 days before harvest. And for a crop whose edible part does touch the ground or is in the ground, you're not allowed to apply raw manure any less than 120 days before harvest. And that means you can't run a pooping animal through the crop, you know, within that time frame.
If you are going to have chickens, make sure that their coop is well fenced in, because they are just like easily predated upon. Everything will try to eat them. I had a situation with weasels. They can squeeze into an inch by inch. And it's ugly. So just be aware.
There's an interview that I did with Wayne Herring, who's a small-scale farmer who uses Joel Salatin's method. And that's one of the things that he talks about, is make sure that you use hardware cloth. It's small. And then he gave a very graphic description of raccoons and chickens, and it wasn't by any means pretty. And from what you were saying, Rafika, about, you know, check your ordinances, I'm coming to find that if you have access to the township or municipality's ordinances, either through an ordinance book, which you may have to buy. I had to buy the one for my local township, or like where we are here at Seppi's house, theirs is all available online. Go read that stuff. It's there. And if you can go in and have a conversation with somebody and go, look, I see that this says it's 150 feet. Can you give me an allowance for 100 or 75? There's a lot of things you can do if you're meeting those code officers with the research and everything else to have a clear idea of how to explain what you're looking for. And a question that we have from Laura is about combining disciplines. Like, how do you combine different like methods and ideas together? Because you list the example of biointensive and permaculture together, or are there other systems that you had in mind?
Find out what works best for you. Throughout the city, the plots of land that we have, I can safely say I know what grows well in what areas and what doesn't, what will yield better, what doesn't. Looking at your soils, what you need to add, what you don't need to add. Some places have been sitting for so long. I mean, the soil is just excellent. We didn't have to add anything to them. Also, Ben had mentioned about the zone map earlier. That's very, very helpful. You know, where the sun is, where your shades are, looking at what plants grow in what place. So just do an experiment and just take it from there. Now, I'm going to be really honest. It might take a couple seasons. But once you find out what grows and what doesn't, and where you, it's easier for you to place your systems.
The only thing I'll add to that is that keeping in mind that permaculture is a design system where it's not a style of gardening or farming. So, you know, if you take a style like biointensive, and I'm not a biointensive grower, I'm not an expert on that, but if you take the principles of permaculture, it can be applied to systems like that. The farm that I'm running right now is pretty diverse over the, you know, just under 2 acres that I'm doing with how I'm growing certain things. But within those different methods of growing things, I'm always keeping in mind, you know, those principles and way to use sort of ecology as a basis for how I'm doing it. I do tend to plant my potatoes on one spot, which is like this little mini monocrop of potatoes on my farm, but I'm mulching them heavily with straw, which helps with the bugs. I also have gotten in the habit of pounding like 6-foot wooden stakes into my potato patch, which serve no purpose except to give the birds a place to stop and rest. And while they're resting, they're like, hey, there's bugs here I can eat. And so I've had really minimal insect issues in my potatoes, but that's not necessarily part of some style of farming, but I'm incorporating those permacultural principles into what I'm doing in that area on the farm.
I think everything, this is Shannon, I think that it is site specific, and also it depends upon your motive. One of the philosophies that I love is the lazy farmer is a smart farmer. And if you're doing like food forestry, you want to set up a system that is more self-maintaining and it doesn't require as much input. So it really depends on your goals.
Just to build off that, this is Ben. And to talk about the zone map, permaculture, you know, we throw around this phrase a lot, appropriate technology. Looking at different agricultural systems as technologies, they're only appropriate when they're put into the right scenario, into the right context. So it doesn't make sense to use Joel Salatin's system of moving heads of beef through different pastures if all you have is an acre brownfield in South Philadelphia. And that's such an obvious example, but even to go beyond that, like, it doesn't make sense to be growing acres and acres of intensive annual vegetables hundreds of miles away from a population center, because you have to take into account things like how well food keeps, how much energy it takes to ship things, what kind of inputs and resources go into the agricultural system. I also think it's extremely important to consider regionally appropriate traditional farming techniques. You know, for example, biodynamic farming, a lot of the techniques there were gathered by Rudolf Steiner from remote agrarian valleys in Central Europe. And some of those techniques obviously are working fairly well here in North America, but probably all of them won't. And I'm not saying it's not worth trying them, but I bet if you're in the mountains of West Virginia and you're interested in biodynamics, if you poke around, though, you'll find some old-time farmers who know some tricks for the mountains of West Virginia that aren't going to be found in Rudolf Steiner's system.
And I can put a little bit of a joke in this, in that the only thing that my wife and I can grow is garlic, strawberries, children, and cats. And so much of our property is part of a floodplain that trying to grow large quantities of food there in these other forms isn't functional, because I've had a four-wheeler roll through my yard during a flood. I've had, you know, oak trees uprooted and come through the yard. So trying to do a lot of like small-scale perennials and things like that in those flood areas aren't appropriate. But I go back to the social element that we were talking about earlier. Planting strawberries and garlic, I find, makes better neighbors than putting up a fence. And that there's a lot of space that a dialogue can occur that in many ways can be incredibly valuable to a lot of this work. And figuring out ways to integrate not only different farming practices, but also ourselves into communities where we're new and we're looking to rebuild those structures so that we're not alone. That this, well, as you said earlier, John, however we wanted to label it, this industrial society, all this, these ideas of reconnection, that there are lots of things that we can do in that way. But I'm going off topic, so let's move back a little bit. I'm looking around. Anybody?
Okay, so my question is, are there any principles that can guide us into knowing how far to force a non-native species into our gardens to, you know, to make it work for us in our gardens or in our climate or microclimate? I mean, obviously, most of us don't have a totally native diet, but when am I trying something that I really shouldn't be trying?
I think that there are a lot of different perspectives on that. I haven't really read too much about the introduction of non-native species, but if you think about it, horses aren't native to this area, and we use those, we use their manures. And you need to think about the animals as well. I guess they aren't as invasive, but that's all I have to say about that.
I could teach a 7-week intensive on this topic, and so I'll try to answer the question really briefly. I think that one thing that we learn to do as we study permaculture is to create ethical scales of use or scales of appropriateness. And when we look at the traditional zone map concept, which is this way of seeing a human being in its environment and how it relates to the wider ecosystem through the flow of energy and resources, we can see where and when it's appropriate to do things like introducing a non-native species. So the concern with non-natives, be they animals or plants or even microbes, is that they can escape from a system that a human sets up into a wild system and change that wild system. Or from the perspective of conservation biology, which is not a real science, it's a pseudoscience, and I'm going to go out on a limb and say that. From that perspective, that ecosystem has been ruined, but that's a human value judgment. From a purely scientific standpoint, an ecosystem is never ruined, it's just constantly in transition. So when we make a decision to introduce a non-native species, we have to balance that decision, we have to weigh that decision against the potential consequences to nearby wild ecosystems. And the way that we do that is through gathering information. Like putting an apple tree in a suburban backyard is not really that big of a deal because there's already lots of apple trees here. We have massive amounts of, you know, information on apples. Cultivated apples don't escape into the wild, but, you know, the apples from Kazakhstan. On the other hand, putting something like English ivy into your garden as an ornamental is a much more dubious decision because I see English ivy covering native trees out in semi-wild ecosystems all the time. Now, there's a debate about, you know, that plant there. Is it causing a problem? Some people say it kills trees. Other people say it actually benefits the trees. Some people say it, you know, tears out the mortar of your bricks when it grows up your house. But there have been studies done in England on, you know, houses that are hundreds of years old that are actually in better shape because they're covered in ivy. So there's so much information gathering that has to be done. But to boil it down to the simplest possible answer that I can give you, I think, especially when we're talking about plants, it's most appropriate to introduce a non-native species if it fulfills an ecosystem service that there's no native plant that's fulfilling. And that is rarely ever the case.
I feel like there's not a whole lot that needs to be said after that. I knew Ben was going to go there, and I totally appreciate his answer. I'm not a native purist by any stretch. Obviously, most of the annual vegetables I grow are not native when it comes to perennials. I have seeded things on my farm, weed-wise, quote-unquote weed, because they were missing and I wanted them. There are a lot of plants that are deemed invasive that I get a lot of use out of and I value that I would miss if they were gone. So when it comes to introducing them, I agree with what Ben said. I don't know, it has to be tempered with your surroundings around you and what your purpose for it is. And, you know, once you introduce it, I feel like then you have to take responsibility for it, either manage it or remove it when you're done with that area and just think about it in the long term rather than the short term.
I just want to piggyback off a little bit what John just said about your question. Right now, we're dealing with the invasive plant of bamboo in Harrisburg, and that has came up and has caused also some problems since we had such a bad winter and snow, where trash trucks couldn't go down the alleys and all because of the invasive plant taking over. So I agree with you wholeheartedly. If you're going to introduce something, I'm going to go back to make sure you deal with your ordinances, make sure you let them know that you're going to put something in, because it can destroy, it can choke out depending on what you're doing. And when you're done with it, I agree, take it out, get rid of it. Right now, what we're looking at with all the bamboo, what I'm talking to the municipality about is, can we look at possibly seeing what it is? What kind of species is it? Can we take it to industry? My entrepreneurial thing kicked right in, because what they're talking about is digging up. And we're talking about blocks and trying to eradicate it that way. I don't think they're going to be successful because the stuff's been there for years. I'm talking 10 years or more. So it's really rooted into the city. But how Public Works is looking at it, it's a problem and an issue. How our permaculture looks at it, I'm looking at it, can we create income? Can we make floors? Can we make this, that? We're having that discussion. So I will definitely get back with you on how that comes out.
Just to add one other thing to what Rafika just said about your ordinances, it is important to understand the legalities of moving species, especially plants, around. But all over the country, there's legislation in place about native versus invasive species that has been put in place by the political block of the arm of the science called conservation biology. And a lot of those laws are absolutely absurd. I want to give two examples. The first one is many, many municipalities all over the country are actively poisoning the European starling, which is now the most numerous bird in North America. It was released into North America by some kind of literary society in Manhattan like 150 years ago. And that bird has filled the niche that the extinct passenger pigeon once filled. But invasion biologists or conservation biologists, because it's not native, see it as disrupting the ecosystem. An ecosystem can only support as many organisms as it can support. If there was an overabundance of these birds, they would die off naturally. We don't need to kill them. They're here fulfilling an ecosystem service. And another example I'll give is, you know, activists have been battling the Bureau of Land Management for a few decades as they've been rounding up the wild Mustangs off of the Western Plains and taking them to slaughterhouses because they're supposedly ruining the deserts and prairies of the public lands. They're doing this because conservation biologists have said that horses are not native to North America, which, you know, Shannon just said. And humbly, I'm going to disagree. Horse species only went extinct in North America less than 10,000 years ago. The horse is native to North America. So do be aware of your ordinances, and also be aware that a lot of those ordinances are based on bad and faulty science and are fairly absurd. And I personally am frequently subverting ordinances that relate to invasive species. For example, I'm actively propagating Japanese knotweed, which is labeled as a noxious weed here, because Japanese knotweed is one of the most potent medicinal herbs in the treatment of Lyme disease, and Pennsylvania has more reported cases of Lyme disease than any state in the U.S.
And one common question is native to when, not where, as your point illustrates about the horse. And one other thing that I think about, as you've mentioned on several occasions through our conversations today, Ben, is about the zone map and the zone model for permaculture. When I think about introducing something, I want to introduce it in zone one first, where I'm going to have a lot of ability to interact with it and learn about it within that particular environment. If I have a zone one large enough, you know, if I want to plant like an oak tree or something like that, that's going to be big, maybe zone one isn't appropriate, but to find a place where I can manage it, to learn about it, and then be able to use it before introducing it further. You had a follow-up, Claire?
Okay, so appreciate your responses to my question. And I'm going to just give a little more context to my original question so that I can maybe get some more feedback yet, because we went down a different path, I think, than what I had in mind. Okay, so for example, from a grower's perspective, you know, producing food for other people. Okay, so the consumer wants a particular fruit or vegetable. And what if I'm growing peaches, which in fact I am, and very difficult to raise without pesticides. Actually, impossible to raise without pesticides. You can use organic pesticides, but you're going to have to use pesticides. Okay, so how far did we force something like peaches? Ways to talk about that to the consumer, and also for myself, I'm not a business owner. The business that I work for doesn't even know the word permaculture. How can I talk about should we really be growing peaches here? Maybe we should consider some nut trees or something else.
I'm going to flip the switch on the usual character I play and say that maybe the principle that's most effective in answering your question is the principle of the almighty dollar. Because peaches are so damn hard to raise in, you know, northeastern North America, that means they cost a lot of money to raise. And it's probably cheaper for somebody to buy a peach from Georgia than to buy a peach from central Pennsylvania. So, A, why would you want to grow that? Because you're being outcompeted by somebody that's 1,500 miles away. And B, why would somebody want to buy your peach if they can get a cheaper one from 1,500 miles away? So I think in a lot of cases, financial considerations of these different crops are actually reflective of the amount of resources and energy that we have to put in to making these crops happen. And the cheapest thing to grow where you live is the thing that grows there the easiest. We're not far away from the point where things that are environmentally sound are going to just always be cheaper than things that aren't. And if somebody's unwilling to listen to you talk about the environment, everybody wants to hear about money, so talk to them about money. Embedded in there is your ulterior motive, but heck, a decade or two from now, it's going to be financially impossible probably to grow peaches around here.
There were some more questions that came in from Facebook during this, and one is from Zach Ellsworth, and he asked, considering the dire threats we face from climate change, peak oil, industrial agriculture, etc., should permaculture be taken mainstream in the U.S., or is it best left operating off the radar? I don't want to yell into the microphone, so I'm going to have somebody else answer that one.
Interesting. I would say best left off the radar. Just do it. Then before anybody knows it, it's done. Sometimes when you play your hand before, that's when people want to throw up roadblocks and stop. So we just go ahead and just do it and grow from there. And then, like I said, when people realize it, it's already in place and it's been done.
I'm going to take that the other way. I think the principles and the ethics of permaculture are pretty sound. And given the right sort of outlet to espouse that message, I would like to see that mainstream. I'd like to see permaculture a household word. I don't want to live on the fringe where, you know, I'm enacting this system that is beneficial. I want to see that spread. And I'm sure that you would agree with that. There are definitely situations where it makes sense to be a little bit subversive, whether it's reseeding your local environment with beneficial plants, sort of guerrilla gardening. I'm a huge advocate for that. But at the same time, there are avenues to kind of espouse these messages on a larger scale that, given time, and I think it is catching on, not fast enough. So yeah, I don't know. I'd like to see that continue.
Just like the greening movement, I worry that if permaculture were to go mainstream, things would, I've heard the term greenwashing. People put labels on everything like this is green. And when you dig into it farther, you realize that it's not really. So to me, if permaculture went mainstream, there's the risk of that happening because it seems as though people are interested in a quick fix. And so if I want to go organic and I go and I find this, you know, this cleaner that it says it's organic, I'll buy that and it might not be contributing to that cause at all. So I feel like if permaculture went mainstream, that could happen.
I don't want to see permaculture be assimilated into pop culture, but I do want to see permaculture be a household word and become something that is useful on an organizational level to communities. Because I think that it seems to me that the direction that the world is going and has been going, and it's about to reach a peak, or it is reaching a peak, is this sort of clash between community control over localized resources, not only physical resources, but resources like education and healthcare. And it's a clash between communities and the elites who have globalized the world and are trying to control the mass movement of people, energy, goods, and services. And the first thing that came to my mind when I heard this question, Scott, from your listener is, I remember reading an article a couple of years ago about how the Arizona National Guard was actually sending National Guardsmen to take PDCs. And to me, that means that the military is aware of permaculture. Although the general public might not be, the military is paying attention to it. And if the military is, at least in Arizona, is having people study permaculture, they must have a reason for doing so. And that, I think it's a really valuable thing for this listener and anybody who's sitting here to go read the last like two or three pages of David Holmgren's book. David Holmgren's one of the co-founders of permaculture. His book, Permaculture Principles and Pathways, he ends that book with a warning where he says that the economic elites who control the world basically have been paying attention to systems thinking and ecology and climate science for decades, and they're way ahead of permaculturists in their understanding of what's going on, and that they've actually been using things like systems thinking to manipulate the masses and to manipulate scenarios like global climate change to their advantage. And that's why I'm saying, if the people that run the world and are running it into the ground are using systems thinking and are fully aware of the crises that we're facing and are behind the scenes addressing them, then people on the ground, grassroots, we better catch up and we better get prepared, you know, to deal with these things right where we are. Like, the last thing I'll say is the US military has had a peak oil contingency plan for decades. And yet, how many, you know, if you polled 100 people in the US and asked them how many of them had even heard of the word peak oil, it would be pretty low. So, not pop culture, please, but if mainstream means everybody on my block knows what permaculture is, then I'm all for it.
This question came in from Dave Christian, and I apologize for your last name, Agnor. And I'm going to break this down into two parts. He says, I heard to never use the word permaculture when interacting with the Department of Agriculture, but to refer to agroforestry. What has been your experience communicating the value of permaculture practices in today's market?
I think what that question speaks about is really to know your audience. The term permaculture isn't a household word like we just talked about. So there are a lot of sort of misconceptions of what it is and what it isn't. So you can speak to those topics without having to use that buzzword, you know. And, you know, I've done that where I've had to give talks to various groups, whether it's folks at the local library or people coming to my foraging classes or other farmers. And so, yeah, I don't feel bad about speaking about these things without using that term when that makes sense. It's sort of like back to the idea of appropriate technologies. It's almost like appropriate terminologies and kind of using what works best in given situations.
The second part of that is, how do you feel the prevailing attitudes of our society's institutions affect the opportunity for permaculture practitioners to secure capital and participate in enacting change from within the current agriculture system?
Do you want to read that a second time?
How do you feel the prevailing attitudes of our society's institutions affect the opportunity for permaculture practitioners to secure capital and participate in enacting change from within the current agriculture system?
It depends on where you are. I can just only relate to myself and where we are. I'm not finding that much difficulty to where I know in Lancaster with another group that Ben and I know, they were going through certain challenges as they were setting up their systems and their farms, et cetera. I just feel that we have to start somewhere as far as education and having the conversation, starting the dialogue. Once we start having the conversation and the dialogue, I think everything else makes it a lot easier. I just want to share this with everybody real quick, and this might help your listener as well. I had a meeting last Monday with people in our community that pretty much move and shake our city. And the first thing I asked, I said, does anybody in this room know what permaculture means? And everybody raised their hand and I had to sit down. I was like, wow. I wasn't expecting that because I was expecting everybody, no, I don't know. Everybody raised their hand like, yes, I've heard a term. Yes, I understand what that means. So we are getting into certain layers. Maybe it was just the level or I made it very comfortable to ask that question and to get that kind of response. But I agree, you can talk about permaculture and do permaculture activities and set up systems without even saying the word.
One of the reasons I returned to academia is for this reason. I wanted to try to integrate into the professional community. And what I found is I talk to professors about this a lot, and some of them have never heard of permaculture. And some of them, like, I'll talk about Edible Forest Gardens, Dave Jackie's book, and they're really intrigued. So I think that what it comes down to is education. I mean, no one knows everything. And I think that even people like in universities, they're taught this one subject that then they, you know, research and teach again. But then it seems like maybe some of them aren't being exposed to things like permaculture. And if they are exposed to it, they might try to integrate it into their curriculum a little bit more.
I'm going to answer the question from the perspective of trying to change the agricultural system through the use of permaculture and, you know, whether the establishment is resistant to that or not. Yes, the establishment is resistant to that. And here's the reason why. Globally, the agricultural industry is run by a small cadre of massive companies who do not have the best interests of regular everyday people in mind. They're all about profit, and any farming system that shows that it can be highly economically viable on a local level using locally procured, easy to produce resources and technologies and inputs is a huge and direct threat to those companies and their income streams. And so, yes, the agricultural industry as it stands right now is extremely resistant to ideas like permaculture. And to go back to the last question, the USDA is completely bought and sold by those companies. And so, damn right the USDA doesn't want to hear about permaculture or biointensive gardening or forest gardens or community gardens. They give token money to research and to efforts like that to appease a certain voting populace, and that's all that that's all about. It's actually a confrontation. And the best example of an alternative agricultural movement infiltrating that industry and the mainstream is the agroecology movement, you know, which has been legitimized as a science, especially in Latin America and in California. And I just recently at the Farming for the Future conference sat through a Q&A session with a guy named Altieri, who's been professor of agroecology for, you know, decades. And he was talking about how even in his position at a land-grant agricultural university in California, that he is constantly being undermined by his superiors because they receive funding from these big companies and his research threatens those companies. So it's a major confrontation.
Just to add to that, I don't disagree with any of that, but I do want to add a little glimmer of hope because I believe the question touched on how to get funding. We actually met with a local credit lender that specializes in agriculture this past week at the Horn Farm. And what they were telling us is that about 2 years ago, they started to get applications for loans for agricultural projects that were projecting income per acre at such high levels that they felt it was impossible and they didn't understand what was happening, but it began to happen on a large scale. And so they started to devote resources to researching that and finding what are these people talking about? They were used to commodity farms, you know, corn, soybean, whatever, that were pulling in $3,500 to $4,000 per acre. And these small-scale intensive farms that were coming to them for loans were projecting incomes of up to $20,000, $25,000 per acre. And they thought it was nuts. So they started doing research. And the more that they examined these, they found that it was accurate. And so this specific group is actually starting to pull resources more towards sustainable farmers. And what they found is that because most small-scale intensive farmers are selling direct to the customer, it cuts out all those middlemen. And so the income is higher and they're actually seemed really excited by this and are starting to fund these things because they're seeing it as sort of like the next stage of agriculture. So we'll see. I was pretty surprised to hear that and pretty excited.
This question is a second one that Zach posted, and he asks, there has been a distinct lack of women and non-white people involved in the permaculture movement, especially in leadership positions, at least in the U.S. What do you think the causes of this are, and what can be done to make permaculture more inclusive and to provide more opportunities for all?
We had some of that little conversation a little bit when we had our break. How do we go into communities? How do we get communities to be involved more in permaculture. I'm going to come from my perspective as far as how do we get more in my community is mostly Black and Latino. How do we get them more involved in the permaculture? You have to, how can I say it? I'm still going to go back and use the word education, but we also have to develop, and one word that I used was trust. Who are these people coming in with this new concept in my community? How do I know if it's going to work in my community? What we've been finding in Harrisburg in our little permaculture movement we've been doing, people still don't feel comfortable with talking to people. So I like that part when we talked about social permaculture. And maybe that's probably where we need to start first. That's getting to know each other before we start getting dirty into the soil. My own perspective, and as I met some of y'all through my travel with permaculture, I've asked that question, like, why aren't more people of color involved? How can we get more people of color involved? How I even got involved in permaculture, I took a swell class that Ben did a couple years ago, and I'll remember that for the rest of my life. Now, I don't want to take no more swell. We did 5 acres that time. I know how to do swells. I'm not interested, but it was a fun experience. Some people that he was working with kind of like got me involved in that concept. So it was someone that looked like me that got me involved into permaculture. And then when I really started seeing what was going on, it was like, okay, this is just a new way of doing agriculture, farming, living, community, raising family. Like I mentioned before, I just see a whole lifestyle that I was already living, just didn't know it had a name and another type of purpose. Pretty much from my perspective and what I see, people are already, again, I'm going to say this again, we're already doing it. We just need to, someone needs to point it out. You know, that's permaculture. And then, well, what does that mean? Well, it means this, that, and the other. Right now, I'm using permaculture in my community even more as far as the entrepreneurial method, and also using permaculture in a way to help uplift and looking at a new direction for Black and Latino males. I feel through permaculture, they can find their niche. I don't know if this is appropriate or not, but I'm just going to share. I see a lot of Black men in my community. They know how to weigh and grow and sell and measure and secure and transport. They got the whole system down packed. It's just the wrong type of product. And if we can change that product into something, I'm sharing with these men that and these young guys that you can grow produce and make billions as well as you can doing illegal substances. So that's how I'm looking at permaculture and how to get more people of color involved and being very target specific and looking at a group of people and starting from there. And that is starting to take some legs. When I have my classes and stuff and what I'm doing with the young youth at the Boys and Girls Club, most of the people come out are young males. I had a conversation about that the other day. They like it. They want to get involved. They want to learn how to grow things. So I just think it has to be a holistic approach. And we still have to take a step at a time. And what we had talked about earlier, for me, that spiritual piece came into play when we had our classes as far as permaculture is concerned. We're a community. And getting everybody in the room together saying, it's going to be okay. We're a community. It's going to be okay. It's a community. And yeah, when we're not away from when we're not with each other, when we're away from each other and we see each other again, it's that embracement there that, you know, we're still okay.
I think Rafika is an expert in this area. For example, I'm doing a project in Harrisburg as well. And what we found was we entered this community and we installed this forest garden and it didn't seem like people in the community were really that interested. And that might not necessarily be the case, but I think that, I mean, we did get some opposition at some points. And so I think that the best approach is to ask people, get in touch with the community, you know, that social permaculture side of things, like get to know the community first. And I think that accessibility is really how we're going to spread permaculture to all aspects of the community.
I'm really glad that question got posed. Maybe it's the best question that we've had all day. It's something that I've thought a lot about, worked on, had a lot of great conversations during my career as a permaculturist. And I do think that it's a shame. It's really a shame that in the U.S., the permaculture community is publicly, by and large, represented by white men. And I think that the listener's question was, how did that happen or why? And I mean, I think one really easy way to answer that, although it's maybe a little bit of a cop-out, and then I'll give a different answer, is that because it was invented by two white, English-speaking, academic, intellectual men in Australia, and they brought it to North America and interacted with people similar to them that they knew how to interact with. And there's nothing inherently wrong with that. Now, that being said, we live in a world that's filled with racism and xenophobia and classism and sexism. And of course, the ethics of permaculture and most of the people who come to permaculture would like to overcome all of those isms and phobias and schisms and all that crap. But that's not going to be overcome overnight. And in my opinion, it's great to be part of a movement that is trying to overcome that and that is having a conversation about it. And I'll share a little tidbit of wisdom that Rafika has imparted to me through conversations and through our work together, which she touched on briefly, but it's that we have to be invited into a community to share new information. We cannot impart new information onto a community. We can't force information onto a community. So if you have information that you think a community near you that's not your own would benefit from, rather than just starting going and showing it to them or shouting it to them, the first thing that you have to do is make a relationship with that community. Find somebody there who has similar values and can easily understand the information that you have to share. And those people will make space for you in their community and legitimize what you have to say.
I just want to piggyback off what Ben just said. When we got permaculture pretty much started here in Harrisburg, even though I had knew Ben and I contacted Australia about how to put the classes together and what I needed to do, and one key thing was to keep the price down, to pull from who was close to me, and I knew Ben was close to me. But before we even had our first class, Ben and I had some conversation because I wanted him to feel a level of comfort. I wanted to feel a level of comfort, and I wanted the class to feel a level of comfort. I knew where I was bringing Ben to. I knew what community I was bringing Ben to. And I also knew the permaculture class might not all reflect people of color. So it was just having a conversation. I want to know how he felt. Did he feel comfortable? What was the issues and concerns? And can we go through those? And then vice versa. As people was applying for class, some of them I asked questions and what was their issues and concerns. With that being said, everything went fine, I think, because we laid the groundwork, let everybody know what their expectations were, where they were coming, who was the audience they were dealing with, how did they feel about it, etc. I think all those things are important and need to come into play before we move into any type of setup, organization, program, just setting up gardens in people's communities. I don't want to use the word territorial, but we are a little territorial. And if you've been living in a community for like 50, 60 years and you just see folks coming in setting up shop, you have issue and level of concern. And you want to know who these people are, what are they doing, and why didn't they invite me? Why didn't they ask me? So I just think if we do that little bit of background and foundation, now I'm seeing a lot of people within our realm of color that are interested, want to take class. When's the next class? And they are people of color. So I think it's a slow moving thing. But I just think everybody just needs to have that initial conversation and to have that hard conversation. That's one thing we don't want to have. I will tell you, permaculture has made us had some of that conversation in those classes. We've had those hard conversations and you walk out there with a different perspective. And I know I've had as well.
This is Eli, a member of the audience. I think that the simple answer to me of why permaculture is represented by white males in America today is because permaculture is expensive. And I think that what Rafika and Ben have done in making their classes together be really economical is fantastic. But I think if you just look at permaculture as a whole and being in this doctrine, the people who have the resources and the time to really dive into something like this are white men. That's not a rule or something, but it's just where we are economically and socially right now. And I think getting this information out to people, to more people in a more economical way is a huge deal. Not to say that a PDC is not valuable. And I know that an awful lot of time and effort goes into designing such a thing and making it happen. But yeah, let's just get this information to as many people as we can, as cheaply as possible.
Then for the good of this conversation, or permaculture as a whole, does anyone else have anything to add before we bring this second half to a close? Well, then thank you, everyone. in the panel, the listeners who caught the post on Facebook, who posted questions, of course, the live audience, thank you very much. If I wasn't holding a mic, I'd clap for all of you. Thank you. It's been a good time. And we'll do this again sometime sooner rather than later. Thank you all.
Thank you.
And that was the second Susquehanna Permaculture Roundtable with John Darby, Rafika Muhammad, Shannon Silty, and Ben Wise. You'll find links and information where you can connect with the panelists in the show notes. Also, while you're there, you will find Rafika Muhammad's contact information if you would like to connect with her and learn from her experiences as a civic leader in the city of Harrisburg so that you can help to bring about change in your local community by engaging the people and politics of your place. Her email address is Rafika M, RafiyQam, at AOL.com. Her phone number is 717-343-6881. Ben Weiss is also available. You can reach him by email at susk, S-U-S-Q, period, permaculture, at AOL.com. Ben is also going to be teaching a class coming up in a couple of weeks in cooperation with the Jewish Farm School, titled Shemitah and Urban Permaculture Design. That will be held from August 6th through the 13th, 2014. You can find out more about that program by going to www.jewishfarmschool.org/urban permaculture. And again, as always, a link in the show notes. Along the way, if there's anything that I can do to help you on your path with permaculture, please get in touch. Give me a call, 717-827-6266. Send me an email, show@thepermaculturepodcast.com. Or you can join in the discussions at, or follow the show on Twitter, where I am at permaculturecst. I'll join you again in a few days. Until then, spend each day creating a better world by taking care of the earth, yourself, and each other.